WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Swinging 60s, here I come, baby, yeah!
On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Austin Powers and his mentor, James Bond. First, we'll hear from Mike Myers, the creator and star of Austin Powers and the new sequel, The Spy Who Shagged Me. Then we'll hear from the composer whose theme music is part of what made James Bond so cool. John Barry wrote the Bond theme and the music for 11 Bond films, including the title songs for Goldfinger and Thunderball. And our film critic John Powers will review The Spy Who Shagged Me and Notting Hill. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. NATO officials in Macedonia say peacekeeping troops will begin moving into Kosovo early tomorrow. NPR's Andy Bowers reports from Skopje.
The peacekeeping forces have been waiting for Serb troops to vacate the southern portion of Kosovo before going in on their heels. The first NATO troops into the province will be British, followed by other European contingents. The Pentagon is not saying when U.S. forces will join the peacekeeping operation, but sources say it could be several days. The U.S. already has more than 2,000 Marines in Macedonia preparing for the mission. Among the primary worries as the troops enter Kosovo are the countless mines and booby traps reportedly set by the Serbs, which Yugoslav forces have agreed to help locate. U.S. Marines arriving in the area also say they'll be on alert for any Serb soldiers, regular or otherwise, who might decide to stay behind and harass the peacekeepers. The NATO forces will be on high alert as they make their way into the province. Andy Bowers, NPR News, Skopje, Macedonia.
U.S. and NATO officials are playing down concerns that Russian forces may try to occupy Pristina, the capital of Kosovo, ahead of peacekeepers from NATO. Earlier today, a convoy of Russian armored vehicles and trucks set out from Bosnia, passed through Belgrade, but stopped short of the Kosovo border. The vehicles had hastily drawn markings indicating that they were part of the International Security Force in Kosovo. U.S. officials were not informed of the Russian plans, and Secretary of State Madeleine Albright sent her deputy, Strobe Talbot, to Moscow to discuss the matter. President Clinton visited today with air crews at Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri, thanking them for winning the war in Kosovo and putting the lie to ethnic cleansing. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton went to Whiteman Air Force Base to personally thank the crews of the B-2 bombers that flew nonstop from the U.S. to drop bombs on Serb targets. He said that Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic accepted NATO's demands for one reason, because U.S. men and women in uniform made him do it.
Thanks to you and the others who flew and supported our air mission and those of our NATO allies, he ran out of room and he ran out of time.
As the Serb troops pull out, the first of the 50,000 peacekeepers will be entering Kosovo starting tomorrow. 7,000 will be American, and the president warned their job will be dangerous and casualties are possible. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
Police in Southfield, Michigan say a gunman opened fire in an office building today, wounding 7 people. The police chief said the gunman apparently shot himself and was among 4 people who were critically injured. He said the shooting apparently stemmed from a doctor-patient relationship, but that investigators were still trying to determine why it happened. The Dow Industrials lost 130 points today to close at 10,491. Declines led advances in moderate trading. This is NPR News. The latest computer virus, known as worm.explore.zip, has spread across the Internet, even damaging files at some high-tech companies. Experts warn that the virus is spread through a friendly email that invites recipients to open an attached document. Once the document is opened, the virus can damage some Microsoft applications and replicate itself by sending fresh emails to the names in the recipient's address book. Most antivirus programs have been updated to resist the virus, and users can obtain the new versions from the website of the company that makes their antivirus software. A service outage at a high-flying internet auctioneer, eBay, is angering customers. From member station KQED, Peter John Schuler reports.
eBay was hit by an outage Thursday night that extended through most of Friday. It was the second outage in as many days and the last straw for many eBay users. Message boards at the Auction Watch website were jammed with users complaining about the problem. For many customers, the outages are not simply an inconvenience, but represent lost revenue. AuctionWatch.com co-founder Rodrigo Salas.
There are always going to be situations where a site goes down, particularly one that's growing as quickly as eBay.
Many eBay customers say they'll be looking to move at least some of their business to other online auction sites. Meanwhile, eBay officials say they're working to correct the outage problems. For NPR News, I'm Peter John Schuler in San Jose, California.
Retail sales grew by a full percentage point in May, in part because of strong gains in new car sales. The Commerce Department said retail sales have risen or remained steady for 10 months in a row, growing by 7.8% since May of last year. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
I'm going to need you to sign these release forms.
Release forms?
Well, yes, you're not officially working for the Ministry of Defense, and these forms indemnify the Ministry against any mishaps that may occur in the line of duty.
Mishaps? But isn't that what being an international man of mystery is all about? Okay, name. Austin Danger Powers. Sex? Yes, please. How does a hot chick like you end up working at the Ministry of Defense?
Oh, well, I went to Oxford, where I excelled in several subjects, but I ended up specializing in foreign languages. You know, I really wanted to travel, you know, sort of see the world.
That's fascinating, Vanessa. Listen, why don't we go in the back and shag?
What?
I've been frozen for 30 years. I've got to see if my bits and pieces are still working.
Excuse me?
My wedding tackle.
I'm sorry.
My meat and two veg, my twig and berries. Hello, lad.
Oh, just no, Mr. Powers, please.
Austin Powers is back in the sequel, The Spy Who Shagged Me, which opened today. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have an interview with Mike Myers. He produced, wrote, and stars in the Austin Powers films, which spoof the sexed-up spy films and mod fashions of the 60s. Myers plays both Austin Powers and arch-villain Dr. Evil. I spoke with Myers in 1990 when he was the newest and youngest cast member on Saturday Night Live. He was already well known for his character Dieter, the pretentious host of Sprockets, a postmodern culture show on West German TV. And he was best known for Wayne's World, the sketches in which he and Dana Carvey played the loud, obnoxious teenaged hosts of a cable TV access show. When we spoke, Myers had just debuted a new character, middle-aged man, a paunchy superhero who dispenses advice to younger people like this couple in bed.
This has never happened to me, I swear.
Yeah. It's all right. It's all right.
I just lost it.
Well, was it me? Did I do it wrong?
No. I don't know what happened.
Maybe I can help.
Who are you?
I'm middle-aged man. Now, what's the trouble?
Well, see, he had just had a problem with the, you know...
Will you shut up?
What was it? Too soon or not at all? Ha ha! Just a quip. It could be stress or cheap liquor. Tell me, have you injured yourself by doing any heavy lifting?
Well, I was putting up some aluminum siding.
Aha! You realize that reduces the value of your home.
Really? Are you sure?
Of course I'm sure. I'm middle-aged man.
You started a new character on the last Saturday Night Live, middle-aged man. Who were you thinking of?
I was thinking of myself, as I always do. That sounds awful. No, I was just, I was doing, there was a scene the week previous called The Award Show, which didn't make it to air, and I had to play Sir Richard Attenborough. So the hair and glasses is for Sir Richard and the teeth, too, is for Sir Richard Attenborough. And last week, on the Friday before the show, I just happened to be changing out of my costume, and I've noticed that since I've gotten on the show, as with everybody who's been on the show, I put on 15 pounds, and I have what we call in Canada a Molson muscle. I'm starting to get a gut. So it was like, oh, no, I'm looking at my gut. And then I just thought of, this is what I'm going to look like when I'm middle-aged. I mean, it's not going to be that terrible. I'm going to know how escrow works. And then that amused me, and I thought, well, that could be a superpower. And then it just went from there.
Let's get to Wayne's World. This is one of your most popular characters. Wayne hosts an access cable TV show in Aurora, Illinois. He's a teenager who's really into heavy metal. Describe the character some more.
Well, Wayne is a compilation or a distillation of everybody I knew growing up in the suburbs of Toronto. It's a sort of adolescent, suburban, heavy metal experience. And so I thought, what if my character Wayne, who I did at Second City in Toronto and Second City in Chicago, had his own cable access show? Hopefully it would be how I was when I was a kid, which is, God, it would be great to have my own show in my basement. And then I'd have anybody I wanted on to be on. And it's completely, it makes no attempts to be universal. It's just totally about his basement and his world.
All right, welcome to Wayne's World. Here's your host, Wayne Campbell.
Party! Party harder! Woo! It's Friday, it's 10:30, it's time to party. I'm your excellent host, Wayne Campbell. With me, as always, is Garth.
Party on, Wayne.
Party on, Garth. Okay, before we bring out our first guest, we'd like to introduce our newest feature. It's called Movie World with Wayne and Garth. Movie World! Let's take a look at the movies, all right? The first movie is Back to the Future 2, starring Michael J. Fox. I liked it, Garth.
Yeah, I liked it too.
Okay, let's move on.
Did you ever talk in the kind of teen slang that Wayne is always coming up with?
Yeah, I did. I went through a lot of adolescent phases. I went through a heavy metal phase, and then I went to England in 1977 just as punk was big. I went through a punk phase. Then I saw the movie Quadrophenia. Did you ever see that with The Who?
Yeah,
and I went through a mod phase. There's a ton of mods in Toronto. It would be like, you know, there'd be mod bars. People would actually go out and buy Vespas and stuff. And then I got hired at Second City. By that time, I just turned 19, so I was out of my adolescent thing. Although when I got hired at Second City, I had really short hair and a long tail down my back.
So do you keep your ears open for teenagers to hear what kind of language is? Because language changes so quickly.
Yeah, it does. But I'm surprised that it doesn't change all that much.
Mm-hmm.
There seems to be an adolescent accent, which is weird, that people tend to grow out of or socialized out of. And I was surprised at how homogenous to North America it is.
Did you have it?
Yeah, it would be like, I don't know what you mean. Hey, back off. Don't hassle me, man. It would be like that. I really like that guy, you know? And it's strange, too, because people who are in the arts had the same type of accent in Toronto, too. It's just, I really like that painting. I really thought it was great. I like his use of negative space. You want a cappuccino? I really like it there.
This is the roots of Dieter, right?
Yes. Well, that's the thing. They're all related. It's all...
Tribe?
It's tribes. You know,
we just found, I couldn't believe that there'd be any kind of link between Wayne and Dieter, but I guess you just...
Well, it was a friend of mine in Toronto who never actually got to be an artist, but did everything around art. Like, he was interested in photography, but he ended up painting backgrounds, you know, like the splotches of paint. And he was interested in being a filmmaker, but he got into colorizing and somehow managed to justify colorizing, even though it's sort of impolitic in the art world.
For our listeners who haven't seen Sprockets, which features your character, Dieter, would you describe it for us?
Dieter was a young artist from Stuttgart who came to Toronto. He's an actual person.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah, and he was a waiter in Toronto, and he would, like, take your order and say, what would you like? And then you would start to talk, and if it was a hot dog or something banal, he would say, your order has become tiresome. I'm going away now. And if his favorite tune came on, it would be like, yes, and would you like, hold on, my favorite song. And he would go up and dance. And then you'd wait for hours. But he was fascinated with obscure Americana, like F Troop and hockey cards. He loved hockey. That was our main thing that I thought I could talk to this person. Was he loved hockey, and I thought it was amazing. And he also loved to touch monkeys.
Oh.
And that's actually true, because he took a textures course in Stuttgart. And he had to touch tapioca, styrofoam, and monkeys. And it was that time that I knew that I loved to touch monkeys.
See, for our listeners who haven't seen Sprockets, there's always a sequence in Sprockets where he says,
Would you like to touch my monkey?
Yeah, I could never figure out where that was from.
It's just because he took a textures course. And, you know, I love textures. Your eyebrows are bizarre. Can I touch them? You know, he'd say things like that.
Yeah, you have such a great way in that show of intellectualizing everything that's fun or pop or...
With Dieter.
With Dieter, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Any sort of pretentious or pseudo-pretentious idea I ever had, I can sort of stick it into Dieter and Dieter can do it. And it's like, it's not me, it's this guy.
That was Vietnam by Schreibmaschine. And now's the time for Rater Record. What is your name?
My name is Gerhard Müller.
My name is Elsa Bauer.
And what gymnasia do you go to?
We go to the Goethe-Gymnasium in Garmisch-Partenkirchen.
Your hair is grotesque. What did you think of the song on a scale of 1 to 14?
It was hellish yet exquisite. I give it a 9 out of 14.
I thought it was bourgeois and banal. I give it a negative 3 out of 14. And I thought lyrically it had...
Your story has become tiresome. Sadly, there are no integers on this scale. So your gangly adolescent attempt to be clever has been futile.
Well then, Dieter, what did you think of the song?
It had a good beat and it was easy to dance to. I gave it a 14. This next song is called Darwin's Burden by the Obelisks.
So this waiter, Dieter, upon whom you model the character, does he know that this is an homage to him?
I don't think he does. And, well, somebody told me he went back to Germany for a bit. His visa had expired. And then somebody told me he moved to Australia, which makes total sense. So I'm sure it'll get back to him, but he's far too cool to ever call me and say, I understand you are doing me. You know, it would be just too not cool.
You did commercials as a kid?
Yeah.
What kinds of commercials?
I used to actually have my resume memorized. It was like Kit Kat, Applejack, Sunlight, BC Hydro, Datsun, Kmart Shoes, Wrigley Spearmint Gum. Just anything where they needed a little red-headed kid. You know, gee, Mom, this is the best. That was me. And then I went through my punk phase, and I couldn't get cast for my life because I had really short hair and T-shirts that said Anarchy in the UK, and they wanted, like, a little kid who plays basketball. And I'd be like, yeah, forget it. Basketball's bourgeois. So I stopped doing that.
So how old were you when you stopped?
My last commercial, I was 17, and I haven't done one since.
Well, that's pretty old, actually.
Yeah.
I just expected you were doing it for baby food or something when you were really young.
No, I started when I was 8. I did a dancing commercial.
Oh, great.
For
with Datsun. Tap shoes and everything?
No, it was jazz dancing, which is even more a secret. Sort of dancing, solid gold type dancing that nobody really should see. And that's what I was doing.
That's the corniest kind of dancing, the kind of interpretive dancing on commercials.
Yeah. No, there's cornier dancing, and that's... The reason I got into dancing was there was a show on Canadian TV called The Pig and Whistle, which was a mock pub show, British pub show for British expatriates who were, like, really homesick. And it was like, come in to the Pig and Whistle, come in and have a laugh. And then they'd had these Cockney, like, Mary Poppins dancers, you know, with the kerchiefs tied around their neck and flat caps. And a lot of posing and a lot of knee slapping. Knees up, Mother Brown. Knees up, Mother Brown. And I thought, I was 4, and I thought that was the coolest thing ever.
Come a long way, haven't
well,
you?
Well, I've come a long way since The Pig and Whistle.
So that's how you started doing commercials?
Yeah.
The name of the psychotic killer who escapes from the institution in Halloween is Michael Myers.
Yes.
Did you hear about this a lot when
when
the movie came out?
Whenever I go to cash a check, it's Michael Myers, the killer. Just don't kill me. Honestly, I'll cash the check. And I have to give them one of those, that's funny, I never get that, laughs. That's great, I never get that. That's great.
Mike Myers, recorded in 1990, from the soundtrack of his new film, The Spy Who Shagged Me, here's Mike Myers rapping.
From the moment I heard Frau say I had a clone, I knew that I'd be safe because I'd never be alone. An evil doctor shouldn't speak aloud about his feelings. My hurt and my pain don't make me too appealing. I'd hoped Scott would look up to me, run the business of the family, head an evil empire just like his dear old dad, give him my love and the things I never had. Scott would think I was a cool guy, return the love I have, make me want to cry, be evil, but have my feelings too. Changed my life with Oprah and Maya Angelou. But Scott rejected me. C'est la vie. Life is cruel, treats you unfairly. Even so, a God there must be. Mini-me,
You complete me.
Just me and you.
Getting jiggy with it.
Coming up, the music that made Austin Powers' mentor, James Bond, so cool. We hear from John Barry, who composed the music for 11 Bond films. This is Fresh Air.
Who are you?
Bond. James Bond.
I'm sure that part of what Austin Powers admires about James Bond is the cool theme music that always plays behind him. Composer John Barry wrote the Bond theme, the scores for 11 Bond films, and such memorable Bond title songs as Goldfinger and Thunderball. Barry has scored about 100 films. He won Oscars for his music for The Lion in Winter, Born Free, Out of Africa, and Dances with Wolves. I spoke with him last March after the release of a new CD of orchestral music called The Beyondness of Things. Most of that music was reflective and romantic, very different from his Bond themes. I asked him if he got tired of writing Bond music.
I loved it initially, you know, and was very enthusiastic about it. But after 11 scores, where the format remains almost the same, I just felt that I'd had my day and that it was not going anywhere further for me. It had lost its interest. So I think it was better to pass the thing on to that area. And also the style has now really changed radically. You know, when you see the last couple of James Bond movies, the style has become very different. I mean, if you run Goldfinger and you run the last one together, stylistically they are totally different movies now.
Yeah, where you started was this kind of mix of rock guitar and bassy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I studied with Bill Russo, who was Stan Kenton's.
Arranger.
Composer and arranger, and I did a correspondence course with mm-hmm. him when I was in the army, and he was in Chicago. And I love that Kenton band. I love that brass.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it's a peculiar, I mean, the James Bond theme is a peculiar mixture of that low rock guitar figure, if you like, and the brass sound of, like, the Kenton band. And then the bridge, that do da di da do di do di da di da. It's almost like a Dizzy Gillespie bebop phrase, you know. So it was this kind of hybrid of all these kind of things that I was involved with at the time. And I must say, I didn't give it too much thought. I didn't have too much time to give it a lot of thought. And it just came out like it did, you know. I didn't sit down and intellectualize about it. And I've never read a James Bond book. I'd only seen like a cartoon strip that they used to have in the Daily Mail in England. So I knew it was about a spy. I knew roughly what the essence was, but I never saw the movie. I just wrote the damn thing, you know.
Well, I love this music, so we have to right now hear the James Bond theme. This is the John Barry Orchestra.
Thank you.
I love it. It's an odd chord at the end, isn't it? That chord that hangs suspended.
Yeah,
there.
Well, those laid on fourth, and then that. Yeah. I mean, it's such a concoction. It's like when you start making a soup and you don't know really where you're going, but you make it, and in the end, it kind of tastes okay. You know.
I used to love seeing the openings of the movies. You know, in the Sean Connery days when the series was new, and you know the music would start, and then Sean Connery would walk onto the screen, and then turn around and pull out his gun as the music swelled behind
right,
him. That was so
right.
exciting. What did you think the first time you saw the music with the whole James Bond, you know, with the whole Sean Connery thing in it?
Well, when I wrote the theme, I was given a timing. I wasn't given any action sequence. I didn't know what they looked like or whatever. So I then... And it was like the movie was in release in 3 weeks' time. It was what we call a wet print when it went into the theatres because it was so behind. And then it opened at the Pavilion in Piccadilly in London, and I went on a Sunday afternoon and saw it, and that was the first time I'd ever seen Dr. No. And they, instead of it, and I understood that I was just writing the main title theme, but then every time he says, I'm Bond, James Bond, and they'd laid it in all over the damn place. And it worked, you know. I mean, there's no, with film, there's no middle ground, you know. It either works or it doesn't. You know, there's no, well, it works a little. I mean, a good score is a score that really works 100%, where you just hit all the buttons.
John Barry composed the music for 11 James Bond films. He'll be back in the second half of the show. Here's Mike Myers as Austin Powers' arch-rival, Dr. Evil, along with his henchmen, played by Robert Wagner and Seth Green. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Why not use your knowledge of the future to play the stock market? We could make trillions.
Why make trillions when we could make billions?
A trillion is more than a billion.
All right, zip it.
You can't even...
Zip it. Zip.
Look,
ladies and gentlemen of the jury, exhibit A.
Number two, would you please back
Look,
me up?
Look, I'm Zippy Longstockings.
I can't...
When a problem comes along, you must zip it.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. By Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By the National Endowment for the Arts, and by WGBH Boston, producer of People's Century, a PBS special that tells the story of the century in the words of the people who live them, starting Monday night at 9 on PBS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, composer John Barry tells us about writing the title songs for the Bond films Goldfinger and Thunderball. Then John Powers reviews The Spy Who Shagged Me and Notting Hill. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, in honor of Austin Powers, we're playing back an interview with John Barry, who composed the music for most of the James Bond films. Our interview was recorded last March. Now, you not only did the scores for, you know, 11 James Bond films, you wrote the title songs for the films. I want to play one of those title songs. This is Goldfinger, sung by Shirley Bassey.
Gold Finger. He's the man with the Midas touch. A spider's touch. Such a cold finger. His web of sin, but don't go in. Golden words he will pour in your ear, but his lies can't disguise what you feel. For a golden girl knows when he's kissed her, it's the kiss of death from Mr.
That's Shirley Bassey singing the theme from Goldfinger, the song and the score written by my guest, John Barry. What were you told that the theme song should convey?
Well, nobody told me anything. Goldfinger was the... After Dr. No, on From Russia With Love, Lionel Bart wrote the song From Russia With Love because he'd...
He's most famous for Fly Me to the Moon and...
No, I'm sorry.
The score from Oliver, then.
The score from Oliver. Yeah, okay. And Oliver had just opened and, you're thinking of...
Bart Howard.
Bart Howard, right. So he had just finished Oliver and he was, like, riding the top, and rightly so. And I hadn't, though I'd had an instrumental hits, I hadn't had a song hits. So they said, we want Lionel Bart. So I said, absolutely fine. So I orchestrated all the stuff for the song with Matt Monro, etc., and use a theme throughout the movie. But Goldfinger was the first time they gave me the full shot at the whole damn thing.
Were you told, make this theme sexually insinuating?
No, they really left you alone. They really just... they said, go away and write it. I never discussed with the director or the producers. I discussed it with myself, and I thought, well, what is this about? It's a song about a villain. And then I started to reflect historically. There's no songs about villains. People don't sit down and write songs about villains. They write love songs, they write sad songs, they write torch songs, whatever. But songs about villains are very rare. And then I thought of Kurt Weill's Mack the Knife, which is the definitive song about a villain. So then I got my head on right. Then I thought, that's the definitive song. He managed to bring off the most extraordinary song about a villain. And so I sat down and wrote this rather strange melody just based on the word Goldfinger as the opening line. And then I thought, well, who can write a lyric to this? So Anthony Newley and Leslie Bricus had also just got a huge theatrical success in England called Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. And I knew Tony very well. I phoned him and I said, look, I've written this song, I've written the melody, but I haven't got the song. I'd like to meet with you. I went out to his home in Hampstead, played him it, and he said, well, what the hell is it all about? And I said, it's Mack the Knife. It's a song about the villain. And he said, got it. Then I'd worked with Shirley in concerts. I'd done concerts tours with her, and she was very big in England at that time. And Shirley has this one thing. She has such conviction about what she does. So I played her the song, and she said, well, what the hell is this about? It's about a villain, Shirley. I said, don't think too much about it, Shirley. Just go into the studio and convince the world that you know what you're doing, and you can do that, because I've worked with you in the theatre, and you do this better than anybody else I know. We then went in and recorded it. And originally, it just started off with the chords, dee-dum, and there was no bar, yeah, that wasn't there then. And we had a break, they went up for their 10-minute tea break, and in the tea break, I just found it that what we were playing, it was empty, so I sat down at the piano and I came up with a da-ya-na-na-dan, and did it on wow-wow trumpets, and we put that in, which just kind of brought it to life. and then we repeated it down the line. When Harry Saltzman heard it... He was one of the producers. Harry, I can't tell you what he said.
He hated it, huh?
He said, that is the worst mm-mm song I have ever heard in my mm-mm life. But we're stuck with it because we don't have any time and the movie's coming out. And Guy Hamilton, who was the director, was, you know, he was in the Air Force. He was one of the few who fought the Battle of Britain and is very proper and very splendid man. He said, well, I don't know whether it's going to be a hit or not, Harry, but I know dramatically it works for the movie. And Cubby Broccoli said, I like it. I like it. Let's do it. Let's do it.
Now, you mentioned that Leslie Bricus and Anthony Newley wrote the lyric for Goldfinger. There's actually a terrific Anthony Newley recording that was released a few years ago on...
Go on.
Well, I want to play this in a second. It wasn't released till a few years ago on a kind of reissue compilation.
No, because I when we'd done the record, they said, you know, how do we demonstrate it to them? So I went in the studio with Tony and... a bass and a bongo. I think that was the full orchestration. And I love Tony's recording, and I'd have loved to have been in the movie, but that's maybe why they didn't get the drift of it in the initial thing, you know. I love Tony's recording.
I think this version is a little more orchestrated than bass and bongo. And this is a much more kind of sneaky vocal version than the really brassy Shirley.
That's right, exactly.
One. So here's Anthony Newley.
Goldfinger, he's the man with the Midas touch. A spider's touch, such a cold finger, beckons you to enter his web of sin, but don't go in. Golden words he will pour in your ear, but his lies can't disguise what you fear. For a golden girl knows when he's kissed her, it's the kiss of death from Mr. Goldfinger.
Oh, that is really great.
I love Tony. I mean, God, does he know how to point a lyric out? I just love him.
So it's too bad that it wasn't released at the time. I think it could have done well.
I would have thought so.
That wasn't you playing trumpet on there, was it?
No. No, it wasn't. And it was just a guitar and then a little... You know what? I think we did it twice. I think that's when we went back in. We did it just first with bongos and bass, and which obviously somebody has that recording somewhere. And I think then we went back in and just made it slightly more substantial.
There's something about your Goldfinger scores, songs, that remind me a little bit of the Frankie Lane... movie themes, those big Western anthems that he used to sing.
Well, it's kind of, you know, I did one or two interviews with the English press at the time, and they said, well, what is it? And I said, it's Million Dollar Mickey Mouse music. Because it's, and it's Wagnerian. I mean, the whole opening of Goldfinger is like this, it's very pretentious, you know, I mean, it's, but that was the fun of it. You know, and as Fred Astaire said, give it size, give it style, and give it class. And that's like an incredible Bible to follow. And hopefully that's what we did. We just made everything larger than life, and we made it a lot of fun. So everybody went in. They knew he was going to be, he'd get the broad, he'd kill the villain, he'd be happy. And that was the formula. And we enjoyed it on that level.
My guest is composer John Barry. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is John Barry. He composed the music for 11 James Bond films. There's one more James Bond song that I have to get in here, and that's Thunderball, the theme from Thunderball, sung by Tom Jones. I think this is just a particularly fun one also.
Well, there's a kind of fascinating story behind that, because that is probably the worst title for a song you can imagine.
Oh, exactly.
You know, and I spoke to Tony Newley about it, actually, and he says, what do we do? Thunderball, marvellous, you should care for me. Thunderball. So I said, that's not going to work. I think somebody already did that. So it was such an abstract title. So they were shooting down in Nassau. Not Nassau County, you know, the island. They were doing all that stuff down there. And I flew down there, and on the way down, I was reading a magazine, and it said that the Italians had a name for James Bond now, which was Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which I thought was really terrific. So I thought, instead of using the word Thunderball, why don't we write a song called Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang? Cubby absolutely loved it. Harry loved it. Everybody fell in love with it. So I recorded. I recorded with Dionne Warwick. We recorded with Shirley. And then the powers that be at United Artists in New York, literally 2 weeks before the movie opened, phoned him and said, you know, we need that Goldfinger thing. We need that title over the radio. And Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang isn't doing it. We need Thunderball. So I called up Don Black and I said, look, I got this. We got to do this in like no time whatsoever. So I said, what does it mean? And he said, I don't know what the hell it means. I really don't know what it means. So I wrote a theme that facilitated the word. Don then wrote the lyric. He then called Tom Jones. And now the whole Bond thing was being a big success. You know, you could have called anybody. You know, everybody now wanted to do Bond songs because of the success that Shirley had had and the whole aura that was hanging around the movies. So Tom came in and he said the first thing when he heard it, he said, what the hell's it about? In his Welsh accent, what the hell's it about? I said, Tom, don't ask. Just take a leaf out of Shirley's book. Get in the studio, sing the hell out of it, and leave. Please, don't get into it. Just do that. And said, oh, all right, okay, I'll do it. So he goes, and it was the same. It was the same mood. Just convince everybody. And he was so convincing. I don't think anybody really analyzed what the hell he was singing about. And I still don't know what the song is about to this day, but we were given that problem, and we have to live with it.
Well, the lyricist came up with good ideas for Thunderball. They call him the winner who takes all, and he
yes,
strikes
Don
like
did.
Thunderball.
Absolutely.
A decent solution to the problem.
He did actually, in the nick of time, come out with that line, which made it slightly credible, you know.
I love these lyrics. They're so funny. His days of asking are all gone. His fight goes on and on and on.
Right, right.
So you must have had fun doing this. I mean, this is just really, it's very silly and very fun.
Talk about a license to kill. It's a license right. to write silly and just have great fun. You know, I mean, that was the whole joy of these movies, that this was not Citizen Kane, you know. It was just this fun comic strip. So you could get away with murder. If this had been a one-off, some guy made a movie called Thunderball, and it hadn't had the cachet that was growing up around the whole thing, we'd have been thrown out of the studio. It was the whole thing just... It was we were launched. And we could do any, you could do anything really silly, and it's that was the freedom of it. And why I left ultimately was because it stopped being wonderful and silly. It started to be formula, and that's when the fun went out of it. And once the fun goes out of it, well, there's really no point.
Well, it's time to hear Thunderball, sung by Tom Jones, music by my guest John Barry.
While others walk. talk. He looks at this world and wants it all. So he strikes like thunderbolt. Success. His needs are more, so he gives less. They call him the winner who takes all, and he strikes like thunder.
Talk about big arrangements. That is really great. I like the way you managed to work in the James Bond theme underneath it. Very nice.
Every trick in the book we use, believe me, we didn't leave anything out. Actually, you didn't play the best part of the song, actually. The bridge. The bridge actually makes that song work.
Okay, cue it up to the bridge. Bob Purdick, our engineer, please cue it up to the bridge.
The most important part of any song, Gershwin said, is the bridge. It's the release. It's how you get from, and it's the old 1930s pattern of 32 bar songs, eight bars, bridge and end. And it's so important how you get that release.
Any woman he wants, he'll get.
No, I interrupted your thought about the bridge.
You know, it sets up getting back. It goes into another area, but it also sets up getting back into the main theme, which is it's not as simple as it sounds.
Now, why are minor keys so essential in these Bond themes?
I guess minor keys are essential in my life. I love writing in minor keys. I adore them. They're just emotionally more fruitful. And there's a certain sense of tragedy. Although you're playing hokey, if you had to do James Bond in major keys, it would sound like Mickey Mouse cartoon music. It mm-hmm. really would, mm-hmm. you know. It's because you play it in the minor key that it gives it a weight and a power, you know. I mean, you know, you listen to Shostakovich, you listen to Coffee, if you listen, you know. I mean, it's all this minor, heavy. I'm very, very influenced. I mean, my greatest loves are the Russian composers, Shostakovich, Prokofiev, Stravinsky. The Russians have a way with the minor key that no other people have. And if anybody says, what's the biggest influence in your life, as much as I love Beethoven and all a million other things, it's that Russian attitude to be able to deal with the minor key.
This is good, because Bond was always fighting the Russians, so...
Yeah, that wasn't a part of the thing. It just happened to work out well in that, yeah.
Right, right.
But it gives it size. It gives it more sense of drama. If you'd have tried to score the Bond movies in major keys, when you think about it, it would have been absolutely disastrous.
John Barry, recorded last spring. Coming up, our film critic John Powers reviews The Spy Who Shagged Me and Notting Hill. This is Fresh Air.
Snow and rain and the bright sunshine. Sam eats purple flowers. Ain't got much, but what we got sours. We dig snow and rain in the bright sunshine.
After making sure that our film critic John Powers is no relation to Austin Powers, we asked him to review The Spy Who Shagged Me, along with the comedy Notting Hill.
When I was at Cannes a few weeks ago, there was a gargantuan video screen outside my hotel window. It was advertising Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me. And each night as I tried to sleep, I was kept awake by the sound of its star Mike Myers blaring, "It's Cannes, baby!" and "Oh, behave!" over and over and over. So as you might imagine, I went to see this comedy sequel in the same generous spirit that a mongoose might approach a cobra. But honesty compels me to tell you that I laughed all the way through The Spy Who Shagged Me, a piece of inspired goofiness that's about 50 times funnier than the original film. It contains a buoyantly inventive performance by Myers in three different roles, tosses off dozens of jokes too wonderful to give away, and is bathed in a sweetness that's rare in a modern comedy. It's a great pop artifact. Everything takes place on the surface. That's not true of the new British hit Notting Hill, a lightweight comedy that's more interesting to think about than to watch. You probably know the story by now. Hugh Grant plays William Thacker, the owner of a struggling travel bookstore in London's gentrified Notting Hill neighborhood. One day, Hollywood superstar Anna Scott, played by Julia Roberts, comes in to buy a book, and Grant's character spends the rest of the movie chasing her, just as he chased Annie McDowell through Four Weddings and a Funeral, the obvious model for this picture. It was even written by the same man, Richard Curtis, who seems to work not with a computer, but a cookie cutter. Although the movie's ostensibly about the romance between William and Anna, its real theme is how Britain sees its relationship with America. In this case, America is embodied by a screen idol, wonderfully played by Roberts, who initially strikes us as rich, beautiful, and glamorous. But we soon realize that Anna's life is, believe it or not, rather empty. She's lonely, vulnerable, and intellectually shallow. She buys the travel book that's all photos. And her life is overwhelmed by triviality, as when a London tabloid freaks her out by running photos of her in the raw.
The thing that's so irritating is that now I'm so totally fierce when it comes to nudity clauses.
You actually have clauses in your contract about nudity?
Definitely. You may show the dent of the top of the artist's buttocks, but neither cheek. Or if there's a stunt bottom being used, artist must have full consultation.
You have a stunt bottom?
Well, I could have a stunt bottom, yes.
Wow, and are people tempted to go for better bottoms than their own?
Yeah, I mean, I would. This is important stuff.
Well, it's one hell of a job, isn't it? I mean, what do you put on your passport? Profession, Mel Gibson's bottom.
If Anna can be seen as America, William Thacker is Britain in all its charm, naivete, and decency. He may not be very successful, but he's literate and loyal to his friends. He lives in a real neighborhood, not an alienating cocoon of limos and luxury hotels. And though obviously starstruck, he's crazy for Anna after a 5-minute meeting, his love never wavers. And in the end, his unaffected Englishness carries the day. The movie star ends up literally barefoot, pregnant, and gazing vacantly into the distance while William sits beside her, reading a book. He has domesticated the Beverly Hills goddess, made her part of his small Notting Hill world. But while the story rather smugly portrays the triumph of Britishness, its unwitting theme is the triumph of Hollywood values. For the movie doesn't offer us a real Britain, but a marketable fantasy of a yuppified, single-generational 90s London that owes a lot to the TV show Friends. William owns a cozy bookstore and has mates who are all lovably unthreatening eccentrics. When the movie isn't showing him leaping off red double-decker buses, it's talking about stock deals in restaurants. There are no skinheads or fish and chips. And through it all, Hugh Grant plays exactly the same posh, handsome, stammering fellow who made Four Weddings and a Funeral an international hit. For all its seeming celebration of homely British values, this is a movie designed to make $300 million worldwide. Which is why I vastly prefer the honest hucksterism and loony Anglomania of Austin Powers, a movie that's supposedly set in swinging London, but keeps jokingly showing us the hills of Southern California. The movie isn't about the real England, but about Mike Myers' infatuation with how 60s movies imagined England. Austin Powers sends up Carnaby Street in James Bond. but does so with an affection more personal and heartfelt than anything in Notting Hill. Sometimes silliness can be a higher form of love.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue.
Do you swing?
Are you kidding, baby? I put the girl in Swinger, baby! Yeah! Crazy, baby! Yeah! Yeah, baby! Yeah! How does that feel, baby?
Lower.
How does that feel, baby?
Today's Archive Edition was produced by Kathy Wolf. Our engineer is Chris Fraley. I'm Terry Gross. From the soundtrack of The Spy Who Shagged Me, here's Elvis Costello and Burt Bacharach.
What do you get when you fall in love? A guy with a pin to burst your bubble. That's what you get for all your trouble. I never fall in love again. I'll never fall in love again. What do you get when you kiss a girl? You get enough chance to catch pneumonia. After you do, she'll never phone you. I'll never fall in love again. Oh, I'll never fall in love again. Tell me what it's all about. 'Cause I've been there.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publisher of O Jerusalem by Laurie R. King, a novel of suspense featuring Mary Russell and Sherlock Holmes, available in hardcover. And from Reel.com, an online source for movies offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor and comedian Damon Wayans. He's written a new humor collection called Bootleg. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.